Okay, larger and shorter catechisms. We're up to the section of having seen what the scriptures principally teach us concerning God, follows to consider what they require as the duty of man. Question 93 in the larger catechism. Question 93, what is the moral law? Answer. The moral law is the declaration of the will of God to mankind, directing and binding everyone to personal, perfect, and perpetual conformity and obedience thereunto, in the frame and disposition of the whole man, soul and body, and in performance of all those duties of holiness and righteousness which he oweth to God and man, promising life upon the fulfilling and threatening death upon the breach of it. As we move to the Ten Commandments, we need to consider, first of all, what it is that we're going to be talking about. And so the larger catechism asks this question about moral law. What is it about moral law that makes it moral law? How is this law distinguished from, for example, in the confession, we talk about ceremonial law and judicial law. What makes moral law moral? Moral law is that natural morality, that natural conformity with the character of the Creator and the creature, that transcends time and place. So moral law, unlike ceremonies, unlike judicial laws, moral law is going to be of the character of a command or precept that is binding on all men at all times, in all places. So it doesn't matter if I leave here and I go to some other country, moral law still applies. You know, I don't evade or escape the demands of moral law by leaving one continent and going to another. I don't evade moral law by reason of being born before Christ rather than after Christ in terms of time. Morality is something that demands, as we see, it's the will of God to mankind, demanding, it's directing and binding. It's that kind of guidance and bindingness that binds all of mankind to, as we're going to see, personal, perfect, and perpetual conformity and obedience unto it. Right? At no time is moral law suspended. Okay, that which is moral law in this sense that we're talking about here. Now, there are positive precepts of morality that we're going to have to deal with, and we've talked about them in the past, and we'll be talking about them again. Those things also have a binding nature, but the binding nature of positive precepts are also circumscribed in terms of the Bible, mainly by time. There are certain things that are of a perpetual moral binding nature under the New Testament that were not under the Old. For example, which day of the week we keep as the Sabbath. That's positive. But the fact that we need to keep a period of time, and even that it's a day, keeping of a whole day, that's a matter of natural morality, and that is, in fact, something which is moral law. And because it is, it should already have been apparent to people You know, there are a lot of people who don't think, for example, that the fourth commandment is binding any longer. But if in fact, we understand that the fourth commandment appears as part of moral law, then that has to be something which was not just for then, but it's for now. And so the command to keep one day in seven is for now. It's not just because, it's not just Old Testament, it's new. Because there's this principle of moral law stands behind it. So we're going to talk about moral law, first of all, then, as a declaration of the will of God to mankind. And that's important. It's not simply a declaration of the will of God to the Jews. This idea that some people have that the Jews are bound by a different law than the Gentiles. That there's some kind of difference either in the constitution of Gentile people versus Jewish people or some other sort of difference that's come into the into effect for some reason that makes them in fact responsive to and requires of them a different kind of law than the Gentiles. That's something we're throwing out here right away. Moral law binds all of mankind, Jew and Gentile. Doesn't matter whether you're favored with the light of special revelation, or you simply have the light of natural revelation.
According to the Talmud, isn't it true that, you know, the Jews think that the Gentiles are just beasts, which is why they can break the moral law in regards to Gentiles, and it's not a sin.
Yeah, well, they have a lower view of Gentiles, yes. where they take that, but you have to remember the Talmud's just a pack of lies that they've put together to justify their hatred of Christianity. So, you know, if you want to know more about what we probably should think of the Talmud and all of that, Martin Luther wrote a good book called The Jews and Their Lies, and that book has a lot to do with and is grounded in reading the Talmud and reading what it has to say about that issue. Anyway, we also need to talk about the idea that this moral law directs and binds everyone personally, perfectly, and perpetually. This moral law doesn't constitute just suggestions. It's not just God saying this would be the best, you know, it'd be best if you did this. These are binding. Right? There's an obligation that is created in the very giving of this moral law. An obligation created for man. So when God gives this law, by virtue of giving this law, God is binding man to a course of obedience. And we need to talk about that obedience and clarify some things. Again, we're going to need to look at what the Catechism says here about the moral law binding the frame and disposition of the whole man, soul and body. It's not enough. And there are a lot of times people think, oh, well, if I've kept the law outwardly, right, I haven't broken it explicitly. I haven't broken the letter of the law when it comes to stealing or adultery or murder or, you know, any of the pleas that people might have if they're outwardly conformed. The point of this is that such is the commandment, such is the binding nature of this law, that it actually binds you not only to an outward course of behavior, but it binds the inward disposition of the heart. So that if you don't conform, not only outwardly, but inwardly, you're in violation of this law. The performance of these duties, it are the duties, these are the duties of holiness and righteousness. And we'll look at that as well. These are duties that man owes both to God and man. And he owes, I mean, as we talked about before, they're duties, they're what's due by reason of the creation. God has created man in a certain relation to himself and in a certain relation to other men. And that creation places man in a certain context which demands that these duties be performed, these duties of holiness and righteousness. Finally, we're going to talk about the last bit of it, the bit of the question, about whether or not the moral law promises life upon fulfilling and threatens death upon breach of its keeping. And that's really something I think when we understand the nature of the moral law, it should become more apparent that that has to be the case. That God must demand a just payment, justice for the breach of the law. That God has, in fact, promised life for the keeping of the law. Right? There is, in fact, a correspondence, and there is, in fact, a an answer in the promise or the threat to the keeping or the breaching of the law. And that's simply by reason of the way that man has been created. We'll talk about that. But man has been created in a relationship with God. You don't exist in a vacuum. Right? You exist in a situation where you have a relation with God, and that relation entails certain things. You also have a relation with other men. So, question one, is the moral law the declaration of the will of God to mankind? And the answer is yes. Whereas God's will of decree cannot be resisted and is always fulfilled, look at Romans 9:19.
Romans 9:19, thou wilt say then unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will?
Yeah, the will of God's precept is actually often violated by men. Matthew 23:37.
O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not.
Okay, so by the declaration of the will of God to mankind, we understand not what we call the will of God's decree or his decorative will. That will is the will that no one can resist. That is what will actually happen. But we're speaking about the will of God's precept or his preceptive will. So by the moral law, we understand the declaring of the preceptive will to mankind. It's his preceptive will that's in view. What he's commanded us to do. Not what he's decreed will be done according to his will decree, but what he has, in fact, prescribed us to do. So this is a declaration of what it is that God would have all men to do to be upright or holy. Psalm 143:10.
Psalm 143, verse 10. Teach me to do thy will, for thou art my God. Thy spirit is good. Lead me into the land of uprightness.
And that distinction is very important, because very often we have to ask ourselves, are we talking about the preceptive will of God or the decretive will of God, the decree of God? Is it God's will of decree, or his will of precept that we're talking about here? Now, as to its precept, the moral law falls under the decree of God. Look at Luke 11:2.
Luke 11:2. And he said unto them, when ye pray, say, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, as in heaven, so on earth.
Yeah, so the will of God's decree actually encompasses the will of his precept. The will of God's precept is that will of, that God makes known to us, that's declaring to us our duty, our obligation, what we're bound to do, both toward God and toward man. We are, after all, creatures. We don't live unto ourselves. We don't die unto ourselves. We have an obligation outside of ourselves. Nonetheless, though God wills the precept in the decree, he can nevertheless withhold the effecting of it. For example, in the case of Pharaoh, by the declared will of his precept, the moral law, commanding the release of his... God, by declaring his will of precept, the moral law, he commanded the release of his people, Exodus 5:1 and 7:2.
Exodus 5, verse 1. And afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, Let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness.
Exodus 7, verse 2. Thou shalt speak all that I command thee, and Aaron thy brother shall speak unto Pharaoh, that he send the children of Israel out of his land.
However, by his will of decree, God nilled what by precept he willed. Exodus 4:21 and 7:3.
Exodus 4:21. And the Lord said unto Moses, When thou goest to return into Egypt, see that thou do all those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thine hand, but I will harden his heart, that he shall not let the people go.
Exodus 7:3. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt.
So God... God... preceptively... says to Pharaoh, what? Let my people go. That's a moral command. It's his will, his preceptive will. And yet... by the will of his decree, we know that Pharaoh's just not going to do it. He's not going to. He's not going to. God is not going to effect that so that Pharaoh will let the people go. Right? So they're not exactly the same thing. Right? But the will of God's precept is, in fact, a declaration of man's perfect will toward God and toward other men. You know, the problem is sin. Because of sin, man does not always bend towards the keeping of God's precept. And so that that failure, though it's part of the will of God, God works that, that's all worked into his will of decree, it remains the failure of men, not of God. God's will of decree will come to pass. Right? Men may fail, but God does not fail to effect what it is he intends to effect. He's going to effect it regardless of these failures of men. That's part of the point on Judgment Day. We're going to see that God's will of decree, that is, his secret will, was in fact kept, and that despite the refusal of some men to keep his law, to keep his precept. Really, despite the fact that any man keep his law or precept perfectly. Because when we look at what is required, no man is going to do that. No man since the fall is going to do that apart from Christ. All right, question two. Does it direct and bind everyone to personal, perfect, and perpetual conformity and obedience to the will of God? The answer is yes. We're going to begin looking at Deuteronomy 5, verses 1 through 3, then 31 and 33.
Deuteronomy 5, verses 1 through 3. And Moses called all Israel and said unto them, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your ears this day, that ye may learn them and keep and do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day. In verse 31. But as for thee, stand thou here by me, and I will speak unto thee all the commandments and the statutes and the judgments, which thou shalt teach them, that they may do them in the land which I give them to possess it. In verse 33. Ye shall walk in all the ways which the Lord your God hath commanded you, that ye may live, and that ye may be well, and that it may be well with you, and that ye may prolong your days in the land which ye shall possess.
So God, when he gives this moral law, he gives it in order to bind everyone. It's not just instructions for some people. It's something which is directed to all men. And it directs and binds everyone, which is why it's called moral law. Look at Psalm 111, verses 7 and 8.
Psalm 111, 7 and 8. The works of his hands are verity and judgment. All his commandments are sure. They stand fast forever and ever and are done in truth and uprightness.
God's moral law is not just a passing fad. It's not just a passing instruction. Right? It's something which is going to have broader and does have broader application. It is simply by virtue of being called moral law. When we call it moral law, we're attributing to it a certain universality. We're suggesting that there's more to this than something merely local or temporary. So it is, in the very giving, we're told that the intention of this law is that it binds everyone. It directs everyone to a knowledge of what's right and wrong, and then binds everyone to an obedience or conformity to that rule of right and wrong. Now that direction, the binding, is in fact, as the Catechism says, personal, perfect, and perpetual. Right? It's looking for a binding that has those three aspects, or the three characters of this kind of binding. It's got to be, first of all, personally. It has to be performed by each and every individual, not, as the papists and others might suggest, by proxy. That is, someone else can't keep the law for you. You know, the idea of works of supererogation and the notion that someone else can do what you fail to do with regard to this law. That's not it. You're personally bound. All men are personally bound. Look at Matthew 19, 18 and 19.
Matthew 19, 18 and 19. He saith unto him, which, Jesus said, thou shalt do no murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, honor thy father and thy mother, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself.
Indeed, not even what Christ performed on our behalf exempts us from yielding perfect obedience. We're still not exempted from that requirement. Look at 1 Corinthians 9:21 and James 4:11.
1 Corinthians 9, verse 21, to them that are without law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law.
James 4:11, speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge.
So, when this law comes to man, the first thing we need to understand is the demand is in you to obey this law. And it's not a general command from which somehow you can be exempted. You're not. Which, again, is why even in terms of Christianity, you know, we say that when you're justified by faith alone, that the faith that comes is not going to be alone. There's going to be sanctification following along with it. There will be good works. Why? Because faith working by love is going to work in you a desire to keep this law, and that desire to keep the law is grounded in the fact that you have an obligation to render personal obedience. You can't pass it off to someone else, and so obedience has to be rendered personally. Right, second, this directs and binds everyone to perfect obedience, because the fact is the same obligation that man was under prior to the fall remains in full force even after the fall. James 2:10.
James 2, verse 10. For whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he is guilty of all.
Yeah, our native inability does not disannul the obligation. Matthew 5:48.
Matthew 5:48. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect.
It doesn't really matter that we can't, right? The reason that we can't now is not because we were created with this inability. God created man upright. But man sought out many inventions. God made man good, but man fell from that goodness into sin, and by virtue of that fall, lost the ability to keep this law. Well, does that mean it's no longer in force? Absolutely not. And just because you've spent all of your money on illicit things does not mean that your legitimate debts aren't still there. You still have legitimate debts. So, inability, you know, when people say, oh, it's not fair, it's not fair. You have to understand the inability is in the man. And the inability is there not because God created man with this inability. It's in man because man has fallen into sin. And having fallen into sin, man lacks the ability. But the lack of ability does not disannul, does not make void the just demands of the law. In fact, however much God may own and approve the sincerity of his people, we look at Romans 4, verse 5.
But to him that worketh not, but believeth on him that justifieth the ungodly, his faith is counted for righteousness.
And the fact is, we must not suppose this is a fulfilling of the obligation under which man is placed. 1 Samuel 15:22, 1 Peter 1:15-16.
1 Samuel 15:22. And Samuel said, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams.
1 Peter 1:15-16. But as he which hath called you is holy, so be holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy.
In other words, God does not cease to be God because man is fallen. And this law is a reflection of the declaration of the will of God to mankind. That does not change just because man has fallen into sin. Doesn't lessen its direction, its directing power, nor does it lessen the binding obligation. So not only does this obligation, is this obligation a personal one, a one that each man born into the world must assume, but it is also an obligation which must be performed, must be kept perfectly. There's no room for the slightest deviation. The slightest deviation is, in fact, a violation. Third, this directs and binds everyone perpetually. There must be no backsliding from God or remissness in our duty toward him. Jeremiah 14:7.
O Lord, though our iniquities testify against us, do thou it for thy name's sake. For our backslidings are many, we have sinned against thee.
There's no allowance for the least defect in this obedience. Psalm 119:93 and 145:2.
Psalm 119:93. I will never forget thy precepts, for with them thou hast quickened me.
And Psalm 145:2. Every day will I bless thee, and I will praise thy name forever and ever.
So, again, it has to be personal, it has to be perfect, but it also has to be perpetual. There can't be, if you think about this in terms of an advance, there cannot be any retrograde motion in your sanctification, in your keeping of the law. The keeping of the law admits of no letting up. Right? Because if you let up on the keeping of the law, you're already breaking the law. And let alone if you're going backward, right? It's all taking you in one direction, and that direction is greater and greater conformity to God. So any release, any attempt to let up on that is an attempt, in fact, to backslide. It is a backslide. So when we say it's directing, binding everyone personally, perfectly, and perpetually, again, we need to understand these words. They're binding in these three ways, personally, perfectly, perpetually, to conformity and obedience to the will of God. That's what the moral law is doing. You need to be conformed to the will of God. You need to be in obedience to the will of God. How do you know the will of God? Well, the moral law directs you to it, right? It's directing you to what is, in fact, the will of God. Well, how is it you measure your success? Well, through obedience. And any obedience which is lacking in any three of these points is, in fact, an unacceptable obedience outside of Christ. It's not going to be acceptable. Because the law itself, that's really all we're considering here, is the law itself. The law, remember, does not have the power to give back what the fall has taken from man. It can't give you the power to keep it. But it does not in any way lessen its obligation. And if we understand this is an immediate obligation imposed upon the creature by the Creator, that it's a just obligation. It is in every way what you probably should expect the Creator is going to be demanding from you. You can't pass it off to someone else. This is, again, the problem with Romanism and its works of supererogation or other religions that try to allow other people to do good works for you. It has to be done perfectly, and this is another problem. You know, people say, oh, well, I generally keep the law of God. No. The law of God, in order to be kept, has to be kept perfectly. Why? Because the least deviation is deviation from the will of God as revealed to man. And that least deviation points to the defect that is in man now by reason of sin. But again, the sin that's in, you know, indwelling sin, being born in sin, that cannot negate, that cannot annul, that cannot lessen the obligation. There must be a perfect obedience. But finally, as I said, it has to be perpetual. And by perpetual, we mean it has to be kept up at all times, in all places. You can't sort of let your hair down and all of a sudden be okay with doing something wrong or contrary to the law of God. You know, you can't abandon that conformity even for a moment without violating this particular demand of the law. Now, the law doesn't have room for, you know, time off. You don't get time off from the keeping of the law. As a creature, this is your continual obligation. Right? You've got this continual obligation to obedience, and the moral law is declaring the will of God, respecting what kind of obedience is acceptable. Right, question 3. Does the moral law bind the frame and disposition of the whole man, soul, and body? And the answer is yes. We'll look at Luke 10, 26 and 27, and 1 Thessalonians 5, 23.
Luke 10, 26 and 27. He said unto him, what is written in the law? How readest thou? And he answering said, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy strength, and with all thy mind, and thy neighbor as thyself.
1 Thessalonians 5:23, And the very God of peace sanctify you wholly. And I pray God, your whole spirit and soul and body be preserved, blameless, unto the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ.
So the moral law, we should understand, binds the whole man. It binds the whole man's soul and body, binds the frame and disposition. It's not, again, it's not simply enough. The law requires not simply that you go through the motions, that you're sort of giving this robotic keeping. The law demands that there is a conformity through and through. At every level of being, that you're conformed to the keeping of this law. You are required to be conformed not only outwardly, but inwardly. And not only should you have your thoughts fixed upon it, for example, keeping of this law, this obedience, but your affection should be as well. And that's where, you know, we actually begin to see people drawing back. They're not rightly affected to the keeping of this law. But the personal, perfect, and perpetual that is to characterize both our conformity, the inward framing of the soul, and obedience, the outward framing of the body, the frame and disposition of the whole man, soul and body, that's what we're talking about here. It's to characterize both. It's inward and outward. It's body and soul. The way we think, the way we act. The way we act, the way we believe. You know, everything about us needs to be brought into this conformity. Why? Because the moral law is the declaration of the will of God to man. So, being rightly disposed to this, having our very being framed rightly toward this moral law, is the same as being rightly related to the will of God for man. We are going to be not just open to the will of God to man, but we're going to be conformed to the will of God for man at all points. Whether the point is simply some seemingly little external thing or some very big, profound, deep spiritual thing. All right, therefore, soul ought to, with all diligence and intensity, be moved to obey in all its faculties and powers. And so, first of all, the understanding is to be rightly instructed in the matter and manner of the required obedience. And so, look at Proverbs 15:32, Luke 24:45, and Ephesians 5:17.
Proverbs 15:32, He that refuseth instruction despiseth his own soul, but he that heareth reproof getteth understanding.
Luke 24:45. Then opened he their understanding that they might understand the scriptures.
Ephesians 5:17. Wherefore be ye not unwise, but understanding what the will of the Lord is.
So we're to be understanding. Our understanding is to be rightly instructed so that faculty of the soul is able to be conformed. And we need to be conformed. There needs to be a framing of the soul in order for us to have this kind of perfect, this personal, perfect, and perpetual obedience. We need to have a right understanding. This is an important thing. The Bible says that for the soul to be without understanding is not a good thing. It's just not good. If you don't understand, it's not a good thing. It's not going to be a helpful thing. It's going to be a very troubling thing. You need to understand. Because understanding is, in fact, in a sense, the bedrock of the soul. So it's foundational to the soul.
Which is why understanding is not in the brain. We mentioned that like a couple weeks ago, right? It's not in the brain. Understanding is in the soul.
Yes. The brain is physical. But the soul, we're talking about the mind. We're talking about the capacity to understand, the faculty of understanding, and that while the seat of that might, in some sense, be in the brain, it's not exactly the same thing, because you can suffer damage to certain parts of the brain, you can still understand. It may inhibit your ability to process information to some extent, but understanding is something which very often it overcomes. I mean, there are people with bizarre brain damages that manage to regain the capacity to think. When doctors have thought that they couldn't possibly. So there's something more there. It's something that isn't strictly physical, like the soul.
I guess that would make sense, too, because if people are in hell without their actual physical brain before the last judgment, they still know, they're still understanding where they are and they're being punished.
Yeah, right? they're going to understand. I mean, nobody's going to be in hell and not understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Right, the soul as well has to be moved to obey in the faculty and power of the will. The will needs to be made subject to the will of God. Ephesians 6:6 and Hebrews 10:36.
Ephesians 6, verse 6. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart.
Hebrews 10:36. For ye have need of patience that after ye have done the will of God, ye might receive the promise.
So again, where do you get this power of willing? Well, it's not strictly speaking physical. It's as well a faculty of the soul. It's the soul moving from understanding to action. The will is carrying that out. Right. And then third, the soul needs to be moved to obey the faculty and power of the affections. The affections need to be engaged so the duty is performed with delight according to the love we ought to bear to God. 1 Chronicles 29:3, Galatians 5:24, and Colossians 3:2.
1 Chronicles 29:3, moreover, because I have set my affection to the house of my God, I have mine own proper good of gold and silver, which I have given to the house of my God, over and above all that I have prepared for the holy house.
Galatians 5, verse 24. And they that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts.
Colossians 3, 2. Set your affections on affection on things above, not on things on the earth.
So, the soul has to be taken up in this concern for conformity, first of all, actually. A lot of times when people think about the moral law, they tend to think in terms of outward conformity to a rule. But when the Bible speaks of it, it really is concerned, first of all, with the inward conformity. That conformity which is going to take up the faculties of soul that we've just talked about. Understanding, will, affections. It's important that there be that inward conformity. Because without that inward conformity, there will be no acceptable obedience to God. There really can't be a conformity which is only outward. You know, if you're only doing something outwardly, you're really doing it by constraint. But with an inward conformity of soul, you're doing it from a proper beginning, which is, as we learned at the beginning of the catechisms, our proper motivation is the glory of God. We ought to be seeking to glorify God and then to enjoy Him forever. That's the chief end of man. Now that in mind, we need then to ask ourselves, what do we need to glorify God? Well, it's not glorifying God any more than it is a pleasing obedience to parents when you simply go through the outward motions because you fear if you don't, you're going to lose some privilege or be punished in some way, or even the idea that you might disappoint them. It's much more pleasing to parents and to other superiors when people obey, when people are conformed because they understand, because they want to, because they delight in it. Those are the faculties of the soul. And if it pleases earthly superiors to see that, how much more God? That's why we need to consider this. You know, remember, the law of God is not only touching matters of outward obedience, but the law of God is reaching and touching all matters of inward or spiritual obedience as well. Now, as the former pertains to the inward frame, so the outward frame or the body must be disposed to obedience as well. Now, though it's true that this constitutes a lower form of obedience, look at 1 Timothy 4:8.
1 Timothy 4, verse 8, for bodily exercise profiteth little, but godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come.
Right. There's no doubt that if you really understand the Bible, the outward frame of the body, the obedience to the body, is a lower form of obedience. But that doesn't mean that it's unimportant or should be neglected. It does require attention, since the body is the instrument which the soul employs to act. It's 2 Corinthians 12, 2 and 3, compared with Romans 6, 12.
2 Corinthians 12, verses 2 and 3, I knew a man in Christ about 14 years ago, whether in the body, I cannot tell, or whether out of the body, I cannot tell, God knoweth. Such an one caught up to the third heaven, and I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell, God knoweth.
Romans 6, verse 12, let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in the lusts thereof.
So, the body and the obedience to the body, yes, it's lower, but it's not unrelated, right? And the fact is, the soul acts through the body. I mean, that's the nature of the human creation, the human condition, I should say. Right? That the body is the instrument through which the soul is acting, through which the soul can exert its influence, right? If it was not for the body, you couldn't hear my voice. If it wasn't for the body, you wouldn't be able to work. If it wasn't for the body, you couldn't in any way, at least as far as you know or I know, you couldn't really influence or affect anyone else. And so it stands to reason that it, even if there's a lower form of obedience here, it's not altogether unprofitable or even unnecessary. Because the body is the instrument the soul employs to act, the service performed in the body is absolutely necessary to be conformed to this moral law. Romans 12:1.
Romans 12, verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service.
Yeah, all religious worship is, therefore, to be engaged in with a becoming reverence that is external as well as internal. 1 Corinthians 14:40.
1 Corinthians 14:40. Let all things be done decently and in order.
Because without the body, the soul cannot be said to be engaged in any religious duties in a becoming manner. 1 Corinthians 6:20.
For ye are bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's.
Yeah. So, I think there's a little bit of Gnosticism in. The attitude of a lot of people today who don't seem to think that what you do in the body is as important or as necessary as what you do in the soul. Right? The fact is, your soul, power of your soul is important, and the obedience of the soul is important. It's very important. But that does not negate or relegate to unimportance what is done with the body. It's the soul working in and through the body. So this is why I think it's absolute foolishness when people start talking about, well, you know, it doesn't really matter. What matters is, you know, that you are obedient from the heart. Well, and they use this to excuse everything from violations of the regulative principle. You know, if I'm sincere, it doesn't really matter what I do outwardly. You know, I can sing hymns of human composure. You know, I can use musical instruments and dance about and carry on. You know, why do they think that it's not so important what they're doing in the body? Because they don't connect that. They're hyper-spiritualized, and in fact, in doing so and being so, they've lost Christianity. So the conformity that the moral law is directing is inward and outward. It's not enough that you have a soulish devotion to God. So what? That you can go off and do in your body whatever you... there are people who think, well, I'm a Christian, and, you know, so they don't really look at what they're doing as being wrong. And we've got people today who... and there are... the church is filled with people who are common fornicators. You know, they're whoremongers and whores. They don't have problems with standards of dress or issues that pertain to anything you might do with your body, body piercing and tattooing and all of that. They don't see any connection at all. Because your body is, after all, in their mind, almost an afterthought. It's a lower obedience. I agree, it's a lower obedience, but it's expressive of the soul. The obedience of the body is expressive of the soul. And the moral law, if you understand it, is binding you from the highest faculties of the soul to the lowest dispositions of the body. Nothing's being left out here. All is being commanded to glorify God. All is being directed to an obedience to God. It's moral law. These aren't just even a bunch of divine suggestions. It's moral law. Right, the fourth question. Is the performance of these duties of holiness and righteousness what each man owes to God and man? The answer is yes. Look at Luke 1:75 and Acts 24:16.
Luke 1, verse 75, in holiness and righteousness before him all the days of our life.
Acts 24:16, and herein do I exercise myself, to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men.
Right, the fact is that, as I said before, man owes both God and man by reason of his creation. It's really, if you think about it, the same reason that makes him a recipient of this revelation of God's will, his creation, the moral law has been embedded in the creation. His creation then is revealing to him the moral law, which is revealing the will of God. And he knows the moral law from the nature of the creation. And that makes known to him the will of God. The same reason, his creation, is why he has this duty to God and to man. So man has this obligation from his inception.
Obviously animals are not, they're not bound by any kind of moral law, but what kind of law governs like their migration habits?
Instinct.
It's called instinct. Okay, so lower creation, non-rational creation is governed by instinct?
It's governed by instinct, and that's controlled by, you know, beastly appetite. You know, they in a sense have bodies which are not being controlled by rational souls. So they're, all of the information that we have coming in through the body. This is why when we behave without reference to the higher nature of the soul, mm-hmm. we're compared to animals in the Bible. You know, because they are responsive and act instinctively as bodies without rational souls. We don't have that excuse. It's the performance of these duties of holiness and righteousness is what man owes to God and man. The former, that is, to God, is owed by the creature to the Creator. Look at Romans 1:25.
Romans 1, verse 25. who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshiped and served the creature more than the creator, who
right.
is blessed forever. Amen.
Yeah, and this is due, we're told, by reason of both the divine nature. Look at 1 Peter 1:16.
1 Peter 1:16, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy.
And also because of the divine will. Good. 1 Peter 4:19.
1 Peter 4:19. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful creator.
Yeah, so we owe what we owe to God because the divine nature is that revelation of God to us, right? We can't know God, and I've talked about this in different contexts. We can't know God in himself. We don't know what Kant would call the Ding an sich, the thing in itself. Right? We don't know God in himself, in re. We just don't know what that is, the substance that is the divine substance. But what is knowable about the divine substance becomes knowable through its nature. The nature is the showing forth, the revelation of that substance to the degree it is knowable outside of itself. And so that already calls us to this obedience to God. We know that there is a God. And we know when the Bible says, be holy for I am holy, that is, holy means to be separate. You know, we know that there is this otherness to God calling us to a communion in otherness from what is around us. We know that. Don't need anyone. People don't need, they don't need anyone to teach them that. They know that. All right? Beyond the divine nature, we have the divine will, which is expressed in the creation, particularly in the creature. Right? What is revealable of the divinity, what we can know of God, as Paul says in Romans 1, it's revealed in the creation. And that revelation is a revelation of the divine will, because it's revealing the moral law. It's the moral law in the creation that's revealing that divine will. But the latter, the performance, the duty which man owes to man, that's owed to fellow creatures by reason both of the divine will. We get Leviticus 19:10-18.
Leviticus 19:10-18. And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and stranger. I am the Lord your God. You shall not steal, neither deal falsely, neither lie one to another. And you shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord. Thou shalt not defraud thy neighbor, neither rob him. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with thee all night until the morning. Thou shalt not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shalt fear thy God. I am the Lord. You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor. Thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people. Neither shalt thou stand against the blood of thy neighbor. I am the Lord. Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people. But thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. You shall keep my statutes and... I'm sorry, that's it.
Okay, so the fact is, the divine will tells us that we have this duty to our fellow creatures. But the nature of the created order also very clearly enforces this. Genesis 9, 6, as well as 1 Corinthians 11, 7.
Genesis 9, verse 6, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man."
1 Corinthians 11, 7, "For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man."
So there are duties. There are duties that are owed to God. There are duties that are owed to man. That's the will of God to mankind. That man exists in a state of obligation both to the divinity and to the other creatures. Now, the former, again, are respects especially our duty to God, which, since it's a branch of religious worship, ought to be performed with reverential fear to the divine majesty. Psalm 96, 9.
Psalm 96, verse 9. "O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness, fear before him all the earth."
Our duty to God is always going to need to be performed with it reverential fear, and that reverential fear is going to be or should be expressed in both soul and body. It should be expressed in both the outward and inward frame. Right? We should be pretty clear about this. We mentioned always have respect to God's infinite purity, Job 4:17 and Job 25:5.
Job 4:17, "Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker?"
Job 25, verse 5, "Behold, even to the moon, and it shineth not, yea, the stars are not pure in his sight."
This requires an entire dedication and consecration of ourselves to him as becomes those sanctified by his Spirit. Exodus 32:29, Romans 15:16.
Exodus 32:29, "For Moses had said, Consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, even every man upon his son and upon his brother, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day."
Romans 15:16, "That I should be the minister of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles, ministering the gospel of God, that the offering up of the Gentiles might be acceptable, being sanctified by the Holy Ghost."
So again, the performance of these duties requires an undertaking of reverential fear, respect to the purity of the divinity, and this entire dedication and consecration of ourselves. Well, that requires more than just one or the other, soul or body. It requires both. Both need to be impressed into this duty. So the moral law is commanding man from the inside out and from the outside in. At every level, from the highest, again, the highest faculty of the soul to the lowest disposition of the body. The moral law has this commanding and demanding power because it's revealing the will of God to mankind. And the will of God respects every fiber of your being. That God isn't just commanding one part of you to obey, but he's commanding every aspect of you to yield in obedience. Right, the latter, the duty owed to the fellow creatures, it respects especially our duties we owe to men. Look at Romans 12:17-18.
Romans 12:17-18. "Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men."
And we know it's shaped by the relations in which we stand to them. Romans 13, 7 and 8.
Romans 13, verse 7 and 8. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law.
And it's incumbent on us as what is enjoined by God. 1 John 2:29 and 1 John 3:7.
1 John 2:29. If ye know that he is righteous, ye know that everyone that doeth righteousness is born of him.
1 John 3, verse 7. Little children, let no man deceive you. He that doeth righteousness is righteous, even as he is righteous.
So again, moral law, the moral law is that commanding of obedience and conformity. That has a commanding power over the whole man, body and soul. Because the law is spiritual. It is spiritual. You know, the law isn't just this physical restraint. You know, God doesn't reveal the moral law to create this straitjacket for society to keep you from having fun. You know, a lot of people think of it that way. Moral law is spiritual. It's commanding and demanding of you that which is necessary for you to have a proper relation with God Himself and with other men. And as I said earlier, the inability that men have at this point, it's not a defect in the law. It's a defect in the man. Men have fallen into sin. Sin has made them incapable of keeping the law. But that's not the fault of the law, nor does it lessen what the law is doing. The moral law is revealing the will of God for mankind. And that's simply not going to change, right? What was right or wrong for mankind before the fall remains right or wrong now. And that right or wrong, that judgment that is contained in the law is a judgment which reaches not only to the body but to the soul. Which is why Paul says the law is spiritual. You know, it cuts far deeper than just the flesh. It's cutting into your affections and your understanding and even your will. It is effective in that sense. It's affecting you. Not effecting, but affecting. All right, the last question we're going to deal with briefly is, does the moral law promise life upon the fulfilling and threaten death upon its breach? And the answer is yes. Look at Romans 10, verse 5, and Galatians 3, verses 10 and 11.
Romans 10, verse 5, for Moses describeth the righteousness which is of the law, that the man which doeth those things shall live by them.
Galatians 3, verses 10 and 12, verse 10, for as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. And verse 12, and the law is not of faith, but the man that doeth them shall live in them.
Okay, so there's a next to the moral law sanction. But moral law has sanction. Because a law without sanction is not much regarded, especially by those without a due sense of their obligation to obedience. Look at Ecclesiastes 8:11 and Psalm 10:6.
Ecclesiastes 8:11, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil.
Psalm 10, verse 6, He had said in his heart, I shall not be moved, for I shall never be in adversity.
Yeah, the fact is that when a law is pronounced, if there's no sanction, then there really is no means of enforcement. If there's no right of enforcement being asserted. And that's one problem, but the problem is, with us now as sinners, you know, people who are already lawbreakers, they're generally inclined not to care too much about the obligation of the law if they don't perceive there to be a sanction. You know, there are a lot of people who do things or don't do things because of the law, not strictly because of the law, but because they know the sanction of the law. If they don't, or if they don't do something they're not supposed to, or if they do something they're not supposed to, right? So if they don't do what they're supposed to do, or if they do what they're not supposed to do, they know there's going to be a consequence. Persons are very much disposed to ask when laws are given, what will be the consequences for either obeying or disobeying? And I say that, again, that's in a world such as we live. we live in a world like this where we're always asking. You know, it's very much like the attitude's very much like the kid in the class who's always asking, will that material be on the test? You know, you don't ask those kind of questions when you're rightly disposed to learn. You know, and likewise, if we were rightly disposed to keeping of the law, we wouldn't be asking, what's going to be the consequence if I don't? But the consequence is there because of who we are and what we become. So look at Psalm 10:13 and Deuteronomy 29:19.
Psalm 10, verse 13. Wherefore doth the wicked condemn God? He hath said in his heart, thou wilt not require it.
Deuteronomy 29, verse 19. And it come to pass, when he heareth the words of this curse, that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of my heart to add drunkenness to thirst.
Yeah, the fact is that the ungodly are moved only by threat of punishment. You know, we've talked about this in different contexts, but this is exactly why we say fear of hell is not a gospel motive to believe. Fear of hell indicates that, you know, your belief is one that's being driven, just like people who ask about the consequence of not keeping the law. You know, they're asking, what will happen? What will befall me if I don't keep the law? Am I going to be okay? Of course, you know, the law is saying, no, you're not going to be okay. Right? If you don't keep this law, death has been threatened upon the breach of it. If you don't keep this law, you're going to be brought to eternal ruin. Now, adding these sanctions, that is, these threats of death and other things, this is really to add a strong motive to obedience. Look at Deuteronomy 11, 26 to 28.
Deuteronomy 11, 26 through 28. Behold, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse. A blessing if ye obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you this day, and a curse if ye will not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside out of the way which I command you this day, to go after other gods which ye have not known.
So God, by way of sanctions, he has the carrot and he has the stick, right? He's going to promise a blessing to obedience and a curse to disobedience. And the fact is that even for those who are inclined wholly inclined to obey. The promise of a blessing is a great encouragement. Right? And that's fine. The threat, on the other hand, well, that's ought to be a big discouragement. God, out of his abundant grace, is pleased to add blessings to encourage those that put their trust in him. Proverbs 10:22.
Proverbs 10:22. The blessing of the Lord, it maketh rich, and he addeth no sorrow with it.
Okay, so in this way, then, believers are led to delight in the law of God after the inner man. Psalm 119:174 and Romans 7:22.
Psalm 119:174. I have longed for thy salvation, O Lord, and thy law is my delight.
Romans 7:22. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man.
So the moral law, because of it being a revelation of the will of God to mankind, it actually carries with it an inherent blessing in its keeping, because it is allowing the creature, in its keeping, the creature's actually living with a right comportment, a right conformity unto the will of God for man. And he's not living outside of that preceptive will of God that we talked about earlier. And there's blessing in that, just inherently. That is, you're not... there's a blessing in being in the favor of God, right? And in not provoking his anger. But, you know, God has added even more to that. The problem with the law, from the point of view of man now, is that before the fall of mankind, the keeping of the law was really a moment-to-moment thing. As long as man kept the law, he would remain in this blessing. But under the covenant of works, there was just no, not necessarily any end in sight to that. You know, where it was always a matter of what we would do and our being being held in this communion with God really was made to depend upon what we did or didn't do. And all of that changes with Christ. You know, it's not so much what we do, it's what he does in and through us. So that we're said to be kept now by the power of God, not by our own doing. So we talk about moral law, we need to understand, really, in the catechisms, we're no longer talking about it in terms of a covenant of works or its place in a covenant of works. We're talking about the law in terms of its place as a continued guide for us. And so it's important, as we get closer and closer to the discussion of the Ten Commandments, to understand that God is not looking for us to keep his law in order to be saved. He's looking for us to keep his law because we're saved. He's given us this law to direct us, and he's directing us into that acceptable obedience. You know, he's assuring us that there is no obedience outside of the keeping of this law.
What were the three uses of the law again?
What?
What were the three uses of the law that, like, Luther would talk about?
Well, the first is there's a commanding and directing, and a second is to show man his sin. The third use is as a guide for obedience when we're saved.
Okay, so the third use only applies to the elect.
It really applies to those who are believers.
Okay.
You know, the third use of the law presumes that we're sinners saved by grace. And that's the use to which we're going to come in the course of the catechisms. That's catechisms are really leading you to that use of the law. Mm. Right. But that does not mean that we should view the law as changed. The moral law itself has a particular character, and that's the point of this question. Right? It's not the moral law that's changed. Our relation to that moral law has changed in Christ. Right. So that's the moral law, and next time we will continue talking about aspects of the moral law leading up to our discussion of the Ten Commandments.